Welcome to Season 3 of Swiss Impact with Banerjees. I'm Sveta.
And I'm Ben.
The topic of Season 3 is Impact Investing, the New Normal. Do you also want to do something meaningful for our planet and people, or invest with impact?
Then our amazing and powerful guests who are business owners, heads of financial institutions, thought leaders, political leaders, policymakers, investors, and experts.
Greetings, my name is Ash Bachori, and I'm the senior mentor of the POP, or Protect Our Planet movement, and also a member of the board and secretary treasurer of the World Sustainable Development Forum. Our primary goal is to mobilize the 1.8 billion youth of the world to urgently address the issue of climate change and take action to protect our planet.
This will inspire you to get engaged.
And in this season, we will challenge them even more to take actions towards sustainable development goals, to enable paradigm shift in the financial sector and way of doing business.
Watch and learn how can we, as humans, transform into eco-financial system which would serve all people and the environment.
We aim for impact investment to become available to anyone, become truly mainstream.
See you every Friday at 3 p.m. Central European Time at Swiss Impact with Banerjee.
Act for your future.
Good morning, afternoon, and evening to everyone.
Welcome, welcome back to week 4 of season 3. Our show is about impact investment, if you're watching us for the first time. And the theme of this season is Impact Investing, the New Normal. So if you want to do something meaningful for our planet and people, or invest with impact, then you are at the right place right now.
Exactly. So I was recently at a scientist meeting on climate change when somebody from the audience asked, what can an individual do to reverse climate change, or at least for act for climate action? To which one of the head scientists replied, please talk to your friends and to your neighbors and to everyone. As more and more people know, the higher the chances that we will be able to do something and act. So aren't we doing exactly the same?
Well, I guess we do. So this is exactly what we are doing, raising awareness, which is a first step to make impact investing the new normal on our planet. And we need all people who already know about it to get engaged and make other people aware of it. So before we start, just to let you know that if you like our show, then please find us on YouTube at Swiss Impact and subscribe not to miss other episodes. Okay.
So,
but before we start, actually, as the topic today is food security and why food security matters and what are the opportunities to offer to impact investors and businesses in this topic, I wanted to briefly discuss about food security and food sovereignty, because many people don't actually know exactly what's the difference and what is the food sovereignty. So, you know,
it, honestly speaking, even I didn't know it, but go ahead.
So the first food forum on food sovereignty happened in 2007. And the widely used definition that emerged from the conference is the following. So food sovereignty is the right of peoples to healthy and culturally appropriate food produced through ecologically sound and sustainable methods, and their rights to define their own food and agriculture systems. But it's not all. There are actually six principles or pillars of food sovereignty which are defined, which are, first, food must be appropriate for the population and not simply a commodity to sell, you know, like commodity stock market. Nowadays, you can buy whatever food possible. Second, that food provides deserve to be valued, sustained, and treated with dignity. Food providers, yes, it's very important, you know, because without those people, we have no food. Third is food systems should be localized and bring consumers and producers together. Fourth, local control and cooperation over land and water resources are imperative. Fifth, generational knowledge and skills are at the core of strengthening food sovereignty. And the last but not least, of course, the sixth point, food systems must be environmentally and ecologically regenerative.
It seems like we are not doing any of it if you look at our present food system. But now I'm lost. So what is the difference between food sovereignty and food security?
So food sovereignty is community-driven and culturally appropriate in addition. The food security means having physical access and economic means to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food. And it's indeed very familiar or sounds similar to food sovereignty. But it's missing certain key aspects, like, in short, food sovereignty is responsible, sustainable, and regenerative improvement upon the basics of food security is necessary. Right. So did you understand now?
Yeah, no. Little bit. Go ahead.
And little story from my past, because when we are talking about food and food for all population on the planet, I always remember my grandmother who used to say that if you have food to eat, this is a big thing. She went through the Second World War and they were starving, so eating some grass in the fields and finding old potatoes. So the humans are very funny creatures, you know. When the tummy is empty, we have just one problem. Once it's full, we have thousands of problems coming to our minds, right? So if you are an investor, of course, enormous opportunities, as it is not a secret that people need to eat every single day. But what are those special opportunities with impact? This is what we are going to talk today.
Perfect.
So then now I handle to your story because I'm really curious what you have to say on today's topic.
So before I start, I just wanted to recommend to all the viewers, please watch the speech that Greta Thunberg gave at the UN Climate Change this, I think, a couple of days back. And I will always remain her fan because she speaks not only for her generation or the future generation, but she also speaks for the present generation. Well, today is about food sovereignty and security. Before we call our guest in, I would just like to say a few words on the situation we are now. So I was in a, like I mentioned earlier, I was in a scientist conference and in the meeting of the climate leadership. And the head of one of the science councils mentioned that Earth has 9 tipping points of this. And in this decade, five of them has been activated.
Which tipping points are you talking about?
So Earth has basically 9 very big tipping points. One is the Greenland's ice sheet, mm-hmm. Arctic sea ice, boreal forest, Amazon rainforest, which everybody knows, mm-hmm. West Antarctic ice sheet, Atlantic circulation of the ocean currents, Arctic sea ice, permafrost in your country, mm-hmm. in Russia, coral reefs, of course, mainly what we know as of Australia, and the Weichs Basin.
I'm citizen of the world, so my country is the planet Earth, just to you, for you to know it as well.
Thank you. And Owen Gaffney of the Stockholm Resilience Center said, just this decade, Earth's sleeping giants appeared largely still slumbering. But now they are stirring. We are measuring very large changes, which should concern everyone. So the proximity of tipping points, the nearer we get to them, provides an extremely strong case that the world faces a planetary emergency. So that brings us also to the food sovereignty, what the recent effects of climate change and the COVID pandemic has made us realize that how much each of us, doesn't matter in which country of the world we live, should strive for food sovereignty and security and how to achieve it. And that's why today we have one of the internationally known experts on this topic as our guest today.
So let's welcome Her Excellency Professor Dr. Amina Gharib-Fakim for the third time, which is, of course, our pleasure, to our TV show. Welcome.
It's our honor.
Amina, yes, it's our honor to have you with us today again.
Hello, thank hello, you, Amina. How are you?
You're well in Zurich, still in Switzerland. Are you in Mauritius?
Yes. And from now on, we should be able to travel because we opened up today.
Really? Oh,
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Completely, or how does it work?
Completely.
No,
so there's no quarantine. Yes.
So now we should plan the trip to Mauritius, right?
Yes.
So there's also no quarantine necessary.
No, except the PCR test before in the usual protocol, But no quarantine when you come. So, but then, of course, when you're here, then I suppose a few days later, you still have to do one of the tests and that's it.
Okay.
Right. That's Thank good. You. But Amina, please let me introduce you to our viewers who maybe missed the two previous shows. So Amina, you are a professor, biodiversity scientist, entrepreneur, author, and sixth president of the Republic of Mauritius. Among your many positions, you are also the managing director of the Center International de Développement Pharmaceutique Research and Innovation, as well as professor of organic chemistry with an endowed chair at the University of Mauritius. Wow.
I never liked organic chemistry. I always preferred inorganic chemistry.
No, you had bad teachers.
I'm not done yet. Wait. Since 2001, you have served successively as dean of the Faculty of Science and Pro Vice Chancellor, and also worked at the Mauritius Research Council as manager for research. Okay, we know you've done a lot of research, so a lot of to discuss today. And as a founding member of the Pan-African Association of African Medical Plants, you co-authored the first ever African herbal pharmacopoeia and many more books on biodiversity conservation and sustainable development. And finally, in June 2016 to 2019, you were in the Forbes list for the 100 most powerful women in Africa. So, yes,
that's welcome.
Welcome to the show with that.
So,
you want to start with our huge question.
Yeah. So first of all, Amina, welcome. And can you tell us more about yourself and why did you choose biodiversity as your subject or as your field of expertise?
Thank you so much for having me on your TV show, Ben and Svetlana. You know, I have always been passionate about chemistry. And I studied chemistry, as you have rightly said. But when I came back to Mauritius, I was still looking for that chemistry. And then I started dabbling in the chemistry of plants. And as you know, plants are living chemical laboratories. So as I live in a biodiversity hotspot, which the Mascarene Islands are, the chances of me finding new molecules and, of course, documenting, publishing, adding to the body of literature, so that appealed to me. And this is how I landed in the pot of plants. And of course, then when you start delving in the world of plants, you discover the beauty of nature and biodiversity in all its majesty. So that's what I do. This is what I've been doing. I was fascinated, I still am. But unfortunately, we are careering towards destruction, right? And massive extinction, the sixth, I think, massive extinction that we are facing up to. In fact, not later than yesterday, the United States has reported that 23 bird species have gone to extinction.
Yeah.
That's yesterday. So this is where we are, unfortunately. Yeah.
Jen, diving right into the topic, why do you think food sovereignty matters? And is it valid for both developed and developing countries? What's your opinion on that?
Well, food matters, period, right? And we have seen how over the past 18 months during the pandemic, how this became an issue for countries that have no social safety net and those people who could not afford the basics. And food to me and to many people is a fundamental human right. And so this is why it matters to have this discussion today on not just food security, access to food, but more importantly, food sovereignty. And I think you have given a brilliant description at the beginning of your show of what food sovereignty means. And this is something that we have to discuss and get it to people that, beyond the corporate sector, food matters and the way we grow it matters and why people have to be at the center of the food system and not the other way around.
Exactly. Yep. And there's one of the discussions we also had in the past that, a decade ago, a lot of leaders from developed nations agreed to transfer a certain amount of money to developing countries and to help them reduce their carbon emission, but also adapt to the climate crisis. And this promise was reconfirmed in 2015 in Paris, where the leaders again agreed to transfer $100 billion a year to the global south. And at least half of that should go for adaptation. But I read that this deadline was again missed last year. And I remember the last time we spoke, you had also spoken about this. And now we are again facing this long chain of meetings and presentations at the United Nations with so many similar statements of empty words. So my question to you would be, where is this leading to? And what is your opinion on this, about the global north supporting the global south?
I think you have rightly mentioned the $100 billion in terms of capitalization of the Green Fund. This was the promise made in Paris, as we have said again, in 2015. And just to put this in context, Ben, is that we are talking about $100 billion in a world GDP of around $100 trillion. So you can do the percentage and you can see how small this is. Now, is this charity? No. I will explain why it is not charity. Because if you look at the way the world is, if you look at the global south, the lungs of the world are in the global south. The biodiversity of the world is in the global south. And why biodiversity matters is because biodiversity represents the branch on which humanity is sitting on. And what we are doing right now is we are busy chopping down that branch. So we are all going to go together with it. Yep. Now, why it matters again? Because, the COVID has done a wonderful thing. Because the COVID has shown how interconnected we are with each other. Now, if we had been talking, having this conversation 100 years ago, what happened in China wouldn't have mattered to the United States or wouldn't have mattered to Switzerland because we would have been confined there. But how we are now connected physically, and now, of course, as we speak, we are connected virtually as well. What happens if a butterfly flutters in Beijing? The effect will be felt in New York. So the speed at which this virus has traveled across the world has been just mind-boggling. So it is showing us something very, very important. We are all interconnected. We all form part of the ecosystem of this world. And whatever happens to one part of the world should matter to the rest. Now, come back again to the $100 billion. The $100 billion was meant to help the countries in the South adapt to the vagaries of climate change. Why do these countries have to adapt? Because they need to stop, for example, amongst many other things, the destruction of the ecosystem. Now, by preventing the destruction of the ecosystem, we are safeguarding that branch on which we're sitting on. So what I keep saying to policymakers is that these $100 billion is the bare minimum, and it is not a charity. By making countries adapt, by making countries of the South adapt and transition to green energy, it's again going to help, because the biggest polluters have been the first world, because, I mean, they were there in the Industrial Revolution, right? We all agree on this. Countries like, well, continent like Africa, many countries in Africa, many countries in Asia, now they are catching up with the pollution, but they need to be supported to be able to transition to clean energy. And we have seen over the past few days that the biggest culprit remains emission. And this is going to be discussed again in Glasgow, but the biggest problem to this world is emission. So we have to target towards zero emission. And targeting zero emission by 2050 is simply ridiculous. We're going to have to move faster. 2050 is, I mean, nature doesn't adapt to the political agenda of politicians. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Nature has had enough of being insulted, and she's going to take her revenge.
that's correct. No, I was just thinking about one point that one of the things we read is that the money is there. I mean, if you look at the COVID, when the COVID came, the governments all around the world put aside something like $4 trillion has been spent now against the COVID thing. But the promise was made that this money will be invested in green and investments and production of biodiversity, everything. That was the promise. In reality, I think it is 2 or 3% has gone there, but the rest is going to get the world back on its old way of working as it has been, to get again everybody in the plane and traveling and everything. So basically, the promise was not kept. But your point, which you just made, the money is there, only it's not going.
You mentioned the
wrong direction. Yeah.
Yeah, but you mentioned the COVID fund. I'm sorry again to have to highlight this. Crumbs, if only crumbs, small crumbs have reached the developing world. The COVID fund has still remained. I mean, I'm sorry to have to say this. Developed countries now, they are racing towards getting the third dose for the COVID, for the COVID vaccine. Some parts of the developing world haven't yet had the first dose. Now, if you draw the same parallel to what's going to happen to the fight with climate change, then we are in really, really big trouble, because this kind of attitude, this kind of selfishness will not save us. And when we are all going to go together, we are all going to go together. Because I tell you one thing, Ben, the reality in many countries, be it in countries like Southeast Asia, being in many parts of Africa, being many parts of Latin America, flooding, fires, all these, famine, all these have been the realities of all these countries. Now, why are people now talking about this now? It's because New York has now been flooded. It's because Germany has 49 degrees. It's like we saw fires in Germany. We saw now fires in Australia. Now people are taking notice because it is touching the places where it never reached before. So These are things that we have to say. I'm sorry, I'm going to say it. You know, I'm no diplomat. I'm going to say the things
you
as
can
they
say
are.
Anything, Amina. You know, this is
the reality. Yeah, that is the reality of our world today. We saw the race towards getting vaccines when the COVID struck. We are still seeing a lot of lethargy when it comes to fighting climate. And I've said this in the past. I will say it again. Very soon, the climate challenges will make COVID look like child play.
That's true.
We haven't woken up. We haven't woken up to this, and unfortunately, our children are going to or will be those who will have to bear the brunt of this.
Exactly.
I'm even a bit scared, you know. I mean, I try to stay positive or realistic, you know, not optimistic, just realistic. But I mean, you made me think again, you know, like, what can we do more, also us, not only the ones who are already doing, but also us. Anyway, let's talk about your book, because you told us that you're going to write a new book called African Herbal Pharmacopoeia. Some people don't know what is that. Maybe you can quickly explain. My first question would be, what made you write this book and what is this book about?
This book, in fact, was written a few years ago, and we did we had to do something about this because, you know, when we look, we had a survey done on the various remedies, because, you know, we have to posit this. Over 60% or when we go to the chemist shop, over 60% of the drugs which are sold out there, they have a molecule coming from nature. And out of the 60%, 25% still come from medicinal plants. And we can, if now, if we add antibiotics in there, of course, the number will rise again. Now, human brain, we are ingenious up to a certain point, but we still can't cope or copy or, you know, match with what nature can do. So the diversity of the molecules in plants, they are there to provide us with the appropriate remedies when we are sick or, you know, as now we have seen COVID, for example. So what do we need to do in order for people up in the north where the market is to know what is the diversity of plants from Africa? So what we did is that we found that we did that survey that many plants did not reach the market because they did not meet to the appropriate norms, the trading standards, as has been said. So we got together as a group of scientists, of course, friends of this remedy, the phyto remedies, and we decided to write this African Herbal Pharmacopoeia, the first edition. The idea is to actually put the trading standards that farmers can adhere to so that their products can reach the market. And this has been a big success because it has been an eye-opener for many farmers, of course, agriculturists on the continent. But we now want to do much more. We want to do a second edition with some colleagues. But what I'm also trying to do at my level is do a compendium of the biodiversity and the medicinal plant of the Southwest Indian Ocean, Why I'm trying to do this? Because we are in a biodiversity hotspot. And as I said, there are so many plants that are there. And unfortunately, they're being lost because of the vagaries of climate change, human impact, the footprint of mankind. So we are really in a race against time to see to it that this documentation is there. Why the documentation matter is that in many countries, for example, in China, the Chinese pharmacopoeia has been there, has been fully documented. And because of the documentation of the Chinese pharmacopoeia that we got artemisinin, and the Nobel was given in 2015 for this discovery. But in Africa, the transmission has remained oral. So we have to document the knowledge, because when the plant disappears, the knowledge also goes with it. Mm-hmm. And as there's a saying in Africa, whenever we lose an elderly, we lose a library. So my work is now focused on documenting as much of these knowledge and plants, of course, and highlight the critical status of this plant, because some of them are literally on the verge of extinction as well. So that this is the work that I'm trying to do. And beyond this, I'm also trying to alert public opinion and make them realize how fragile this ecosystem is. Mm-hmm. And why, when we protect a plant, we should not just protect the plant, we should also protect the ecosystem. Because when the ecosystem is destroyed, the plant also will go with it. So this has been the focus of my work, and I intend to carry on with this for a long time.
Where can we get this book? Is it possible to order online or something? I'm very curious to
A few of these books are available on Amazon, so there's quite a few there. But otherwise, my website can provide some information on how to access these books.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much. So we continue with the same topic that you said. So that is the local food and indigenous food, which your book also said. But one thing that we learned from COVID is that every country and continent should start thinking about having their own food. Because, once the supply chain gets disrupted or something, it is, and a lot of countries are depending on other countries. But isn't it also true that the geographical location also matters? For example, how would Scandinavia get vegetables or fruits, or if they have to grow everything by themselves?
Well, unfortunately, you won't get better diversity in Scandinavia. You'll get more diversity.
Exactly.
So when you look at your plate every night, when my children were small, I was telling them, every time you eat, look at your plate, and your plate shows the diversity that the world brings. If you look at tomatoes, they have come from South America. If you look at potatoes, they've come from South America. Rice will come from Asia. Onions and all this garlic will come from the Middle East. So this has been the contribution of the world. Now, one thing that has to be pointed out, the food system and the food sovereignty, as you have mentioned earlier on, and food security, unfortunately, this is also going political. Because what we seem to forget, and this has been highlighted during the COVID era as well, is that almost 70% of the world's population, they get the food supply from small farmers. And I think a few months ago, Ben, when we discussed agriculture again on your show, we highlighted that that intensive farming, for example, generates almost 40% of greenhouse gas emissions. So now this has become now the forum for challenge. And there is a tendency to actually privatize the cultivation and, of course, the foods, the entire food structure. There is attempt to corporatize it. Now, if we are going to do the same thing as we have done for the COVID and corporatize food as well, then we are going to have problem. Because when we look at the diversity of our diet, and we cannot have a system like the Coca-Cola system where it's harmonized, it's a one size fits all for the rest of the world. It can't be. It is not possible. And what we have seen also in Africa and also in Asia is that there are many what I call neglected plant species or underutilized species that can provide and, of course, solve the issue of hidden hunger, because they're so rich in micronutrients, the diversity is there, but unfortunately, they don't come mainstream. So this is why we need to protect that food system and see to it that it is, I know there's a lot of currents going on right now to corporatize it. So we have to ensure that the farmers' system is maintained, the diversity, the farming structure, and also how to protect, not to prevent greenhouse gas emission through commercial intensive farming. And this is where we have to protect the soil. And there's so many moving parts there, because we look at food security, we look at soil structure, we look at the farmers' interest and the smallholders' interest. All these are coming together when we look at the food system. So we need to find a way where we protect the rights of these farmers, we protect the diversity of the diets, and we ensure that food security is there. And also, we should not be impacting. I see a lot of very trendy words going around, nature-based solution, smart agriculture. All this is fine, but it is not possible for countries in the South where they are already cash-strapped. They don't have access to technology, and imposing this on them will just mean more people being pushed into poverty. And the other thing that we also have to be mindful is access to seeds. Again, it's an issue where the corporate sector wants to have a monopoly on the seed production, but it is not possible. These farmers need to be able to produce their own seed. They need to safeguard it, because safeguarding the seeds means that, again, they are independent. They are becoming sovereign in terms of what they produce, how they produce, and using traditional techniques. So this is what we have to safeguard when we talk about food security and food system. It has to be brought back again where people matter. People are central to this.
Amina, I wanted to ask your advice to global leaders, because you're also one, but some other leaders, I think they can use your advice on the following. So continue talking about massive impact of climate change and massive impact of the global south, which is going to impact, to be impacted by climate change much more disproportionately. And we are not only speaking of loss of land, loss of arable land and food production. I was very surprisingly reading one of the surveys carried out by G20 countries, and it was done by IPSOS MORI and the Global Commons Alliance. And they showed that people in developing countries show greater willingness to do more to protect our nature and climate than in advanced countries. For example, 95% and 94% in Indonesia and South Africa, again 70% and 74% in Germany and US. So what would be your advice to the global leaders to do something about it?
This is again, Svetlana, when we are increasingly addressing the issue of multilateralism, right? And less multiholderism, which is now coming very much to the fore. So let us get again to around the table and discuss. The one thing that I will not favor if I was in that position is, again, corporatized agriculture. We can't afford that. I mean, I'm speaking from somebody from the South. Maybe somebody sitting in the North will have a different viewpoint. But I see it from the perspective of the farmers, their livelihoods, and what they get in terms of yield and what, you know, how to feed the family. I mean, if you look at a country like India, for example, we have seen how families have been destroyed because crops have failed. They have not been produced. They have not been able to produce because the water system is not there. The irrigation is not there. Now, if you look at continent like Africa, 80% of the agriculture in Africa is still rain-fed. Now, in the face of a changing climate, what will that do? And we're also going to have, we're going to see more. In fact, some of the figures are absolutely horrendous. They are even predicting that by 2050, 1 billion people will be considered economic climate migrants. And we have already seen, first time ever, one famine right now as we speak in Madagascar, which is directly linked to climate change. So there's much more. Syria, the migration, the war in Syria started because of climate change. The crops fail and people move into the cities. So
and we, Haiti we also.
Yes, Haiti as well. Yes, they're all moving. So we're already in the cusp of this tragedy. And I think we have to wake up. We have to wake up and take cognizance of this and learn to share a bit more. I mean, how much more do you need? How much is ever enough? We have to need to ask ourselves.
No, I was seeing one of the statistics in this scientific meeting is that their prediction is that if we go on exactly as we are going on, in the next 10 to 20 years, most of the countries will have unhuman weather conditions. Like Canada, they said they did a study on Canada where the temperature sometimes reached nearly 50 degrees. They said it was not a natural freak. It is going to become more, so they are going to become more and more often. And generally the South is far worse impacted than the North yet.
Ben, we have seen what we have seen with only 1 degree centigrade rise.
Yeah.
Now just think what's going to happen when we reach 3.7.
Yeah, so exactly.
It is cataclysmic. And we have to wake up to this reality that the prediction, we have to listen to the sciences. And one thing we have to do away with is bringing geopolitics into this narrative. We have to listen to the science. We have to listen to the policymakers. We have to, policymakers, of course, backed by science, and just move together. And all the stakeholders have to come together, irrespective, whether it's Russia, whether it's China, India, Europe, America, if all these stakeholders come together. In fact, if these stakeholders had come together 6 months ago, we would have done away with the COVID already, right? Yeah. But they did not come because now we are saying, I'm sorry I have to say this, now they're saying that, oh, they will not recognize people who have been vaccinated in the South. I mean, come on, they have all the vaccines through the COVAX. They have got vaccine through a WHO-endorsed structure. And now if you have movement of people being linked to the vaccines that are in the South, I mean, it is going to be crazy out there.
Yeah, it is. It is already. A lot of vaccinations are not accepted in many countries.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like Russian vaccines, Sputnik, are not accepted here in Switzerland, right?
So soon for every country, we will need a different vaccination.
Exactly. It's crazy.
So what do we do, Ben? Do we need to invite a lot of policymakers from different countries here on our show? How about that? Openly discuss.
Well, you invite them, they will give you all the right noises, and then when you go back, they'll do exactly the opposite. So, exactly.
And that's exactly. That's what also Greta pointed out very, very clearly, that everybody has these beautiful words of green economy and biodiversity and everything. But the last 30 years, nearly nothing has happened. And like you mentioned, it was yesterday's reported, I was reading it today or something, that so many birds and animals have again disappeared, have gone extinct.
And you know, the IPCC had been set up in the 1990s. Can you imagine? And we are where we are, and we're still going around in a circle. And we know what to do, but we just refuse. We're just playing the ostrich.
Yeah. But what do you think is the reason? Lack of motivation by the politicians?
No, I think it's just interest. It just interests. That's it. What has driven colonization, what has driven all these major movements across the world, it's just down to interest and power. And we all sinking with it.
Yeah.
So shall we then move to the very important topic? I mean, impact investing opportunity in this food sector. And I wanted to discuss about your project, Seed Bank Project, Amina. Because I'm sure this is an amazing opportunity for many impact investors to support with financially and expertise that this would be world known and world impactful. So the first question is that can you please tell more about the Seed Bank project, which I just mentioned and nobody knows yet about?
Well, you know, the Seed Bank project has been going on for a while, maybe under the radar. When I was in office, I was kind of championing the Crop Trust because they were already collecting and, of course, contributing to the Svalbard in Norway, the big seed bank. Now, why do we need the collection of these seeds? A lot of these seeds, they touch on food security, you know, the food items, but we need to safeguard all the seeds. But to begin with, we can safeguard the seeds that touch on food issues, food security issues. Now, just to give you a small example, there was at some point a major rust problem in wheat in Canada. And they were having problems because, you know, once we, in fact, rust and, of course, fungi, they have been behind the Irish famine, as we know it, in the 19th century. And this has been, this has accounted for, again, migration of Irish people to the United States. So what happened is that they had this rust problem in Canada. But what happened is that scientists were, they had safeguarded the germplasm of wheat from many parts of the world. And finally, they did find the solution out of one gene of one type, one variety of wheat, which grows in Turkey. And this solved the problem of this fungus out in Canada. So this is one of the reasons why we need to keep on safeguarding the original. Now, I say original germplasm because if you look at, unfortunately, if you look at the food security issues, the staples in Central and South America, they are based on corn. But over 70% of the corn growing in Central and South America has now been contaminated by GM, corn. So if tomorrow there is a major issue, I don't know what's, hopefully, touch wood, none of that will happen, but it's a worst case scenario. And this crop is decimated because of the nature of that particular germplasm. They would not be able to survive it, exactly what happened to the wheat in Canada. So that's why I feel that all countries, they should have their own seed bank. And again, coming from my part of the world, we are in the Southwest Indian Ocean, we are close to Africa. So countries should have repositories of these seeds. And that's a project that I would like to start. I'm discussing it with some of the people in the region, how we can start with at least, again, the food crop, because the diversity that we have here, and as I said, because of climate change, we are fast losing many of these seeds, of these plant species. So whatever we can do to safeguard these various seeds, this unique germplasm, it will safeguard our own survival in the face of a changing climate. Now, if you go next door to an island called Madagascar, 80% of the Madagascar flora is endemic to that part of the world. And we know that it is experiencing massive logging and loss of germplasm, because at the end of the day, it is still poverty which undergirds all these challenges in nature there in Madagascar. So we need to start somewhere where we start saving a lot of these original seeds growing in this part of the world, so that not only will serve us in that part, in this region, but it can provide solutions elsewhere. We don't know what can happen. Now, going back to the Svalbard seed project, there was a point when they had to reintroduce in Syria, they had to reintroduce some wheat or barley, one of these seeds, the grain that had to be reintroduced into that part of the world. This was the time when they actually opened the Svalbard to get the seeds and to grow it back in there. So in the light of a changing climate, we need to safeguard as much of our germplasm as we can. So this is the project that I would like to start. If there's anybody who would like to discuss on this way forward, I'll be very happy, because it involves, at the end of the day, a fair bit of capital to get this project going. But yeah, it's a project which will serve all of us, not just Mauritius.
Yeah. But are you talking about collecting, like in the Norway, in the snow, you have seeds of every plant, or are you talking about collecting massive amount of the farm products or farm seeds so that they can be sold back to the, or given back to the farmers in case they don't have it?
Well, initially we are saving the seeds. We will be saving the seeds. And what I had said is that because of the vagaries of a changing climate, even the Svalbard, they are witnessing the permafrost, as you have said, is melting.
Yep.
So there are challenges, because there has been a few years ago, there was some flooding there. So I feel that we should have repositories and duplicates of all these seeds in many parts of the world. So if we have one, for example, let's say, I'm just saying anything, just in Mauritius, we should have a duplicata in somewhere on mainland Africa, and then one more in another place where we can safeguard it. So this calls for in a big collaboration, but it can be done because it has to be done in order to actually hand over something to our children eventually. So we could start addressing food security, but the medicinal plant as well is another area we have to look at fast, because it provides clues, it provides solutions to our future health challenges as we move ahead. And we know, as I said earlier on, scientists always go back to nature to find these leads. Mm. And these leads come, of course, from plants, from nature.
And would this be, you are seeking philanthropic support or investment?
Well, it could be, any kind of contribution would be welcome. Of course, partnership is ideal. And as you're based in Switzerland, there are many stakeholders there where this approach will be of interest.
Exactly. You know, I mean, here in Switzerland, we have some depositories in the Swiss mountain even, but not the seeds. some gold and commodities lying around.
Well, you had an emblematic plant, the Edelweiss. Yeah. And for those women who are very keen on getting anti-aging product, a lot of product have been developed on the Edelweiss, because the scavenger and goes into all sorts of beauty products. So.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask more practical question on the project. Yes. You know, where do you stand with that? Like, and to start to really kick off, how much capital do you need, or like which type of organization you would see as a partner? Maybe WWF in Switzerland, or is that it must be some other kind of organization? So how do you see that?
The project is still in infancy, but I'm thinking of, you know, garnering support. I mean, it will be there because the scientific community is very keen on this project. So I'm kind of floating the idea, and we have identified land and space for this. That's not a problem. So we have to seek partnership and, of course, adopting the best practices. So this is where we need to actually involve some of the various stakeholders who will be keen to partner for the Southwest Indian Ocean, how best we can then again contribute to the body of literature, to the wealth of the contribution that we can make in order to address at least the issue of food security to begin with. Yeah, but seeds generally need to be safeguarded for reasons I've just mentioned, to protect our own livelihoods in the face of a changing climate.
I mean, I was thinking of a kind of a practical also application for it, because as you know, that every 1 degree rise in temperature is causing the atmosphere to hold 7% more water, meaning more floods, more cyclones, more droughts. And all the evidences are showing at this moment that the severity and the extremity of the extreme events are going up faster than all the previous estimations we have done till now. So will the data collected from your seed bank help to secure food production even under such extremities?
As I said, you know, nature has been there well before us. You know, if you want to compress the geological time frame of the Earth into 24 hours, mankind would have appeared 5 seconds before midnight, right? And just look at the damage we've done. So nature is amazing in terms of resilience. And all I'm proposing to do is this very, very tiny contribution so as to protect our own livelihood, because nature doesn't need us. Right? If we want to protect our own...
I mean, many people still don't understand that. Many people think they are the center of the planet and of the universe.
No, we're not. We are an apex species, right? If you look at we are there, up there. But nature has shown it last year, you know, when we were inside our homes, all the animals were taking over our streets. So nature doesn't need us. And we are totally expendable. So just forget about any one deluge. We are just washed away. We have seen that happening. And nature will be back again. And that's what I keep saying all the time. I keep saying nature does not need us, humans. There are so many species out there. And unfortunately, we are proceeding with this massive sixth extinction, or whatever you can call it. But we need to make sure that whatever we hand over to our kids, it is something that will help them and their kids survive on this planet, which we will not recognize 10 years from now if we maintain the current status quo.
Yeah, I mean, you must have read that the estimation is that the CO2 emission this year will again rise.
It will. Yes. And one thing which is interesting as well, because you have mentioned the plane. Now, over the past year and a half, there has been hardly any flights going across the world, right? And the emission has still been constant. So it is saying that the plane may not be contributing that much. So what is contributing? It's emission from our own livelihoods. And I've mentioned agriculture contributing only 30%. So how can we reduce the impact of agriculture to begin with to make it net zero? And I can only see one thing. It's going back to regenerative agriculture, agroecology, and how to protect the soil and not go back again to the way we have been doing business since the Green Revolution. Now, again, when we talk about Green Revolution, Ben, we have seen that Green Revolution has not helped reduce hunger. So, I mean, hunger we know is not reduced because of productionist attitude, is how distribution is done further down the line. Mm-hmm. So this is, again, why we need to rethink if we are going to corporatize agriculture, that increasing production will not reduce hidden hunger and will not reduce famine. So this is where the dichotomy lies, and this is something we have to discuss again.
Yeah,
I mean, for our audience, if someone wants to support your seed bank project, how could they do that? Should they write you email, or what is the action? How could they support you?
And where can they find more information about you and your project?
Well, they contact me and I will discuss at least the vision that they have. And, you know, it calls for partnership. And I don't want to do this alone. I want to do it with credible partners, partners who actually believe in this vision, because there are many people who don't believe in this vision because they still want to go exactly the way they have done business before. And people who think in that kind of, have that kind of mindset, and how we can change the narrative by doing things differently. But as I said, for me, it's a much smaller scale, you know, vision, you know, dream that I have, but it's something that can sustain. And, you know, when I was started this work, I tell you, Ben, a few, many years ago, when I started documenting medicinal plant, people thought they were laughing at me. They said, you know, this is rubbish. I mean, this is very low level research. I mean, she's a witch. She's a quack and all that. Anyway, I carried on.
We've been witches for many centuries, you know.
Yes, that's right. But I carried on because I believe in that vision. I was at that time sitting on a very small wave, which eventually became a tsunami. Because if you look at a green way of treating yourself with plants, we're all there now. We are in the midst of all this, and people increasingly want to go to greener way of, you know, the lifestyle and all the rest of it. That's how people want to cure themselves with the greener way of doing things. So again, the same thing will be for this particular project, how to start on a small scale, but roll it out so that it becomes the mantra of many countries where they are biodiversity intense, biodiversity rich, and they have done nothing about it so far.
Mm-hmm. Amina, the time is actually running quite quick with you. We are almost at the end of the show. So as the last saying, what we wanted to ask you is a call to action for our audience. Right. So what would be your message or call to action? You can ask them to do something or whatever it is. Please share with us.
And I will cite Neil Armstrong when he says, "One small step for mankind and one giant leap for humanity." So let us start with this one step today. And I rightly said at the beginning of your show, let us talk to each other and let us embrace each other, and go have a convergence of opinion, convergence of views, that the climate, that the, you know, everything around us matters, and let us get together, put our hands and heart together, and work towards the common good. Because food is a common good, climate is a common good.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Amazing message. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sven. Thank you, Svetlana.
Thank you for joining us, and we hope to see you the fourth time sometime
soon.
Next year, maybe. Which is not so far away from us.
Exactly. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
So this our fourth episode of season 3 ends. And if you like our show, like Sweta mentioned earlier, please subscribe to our channel at YouTube channel at YouTube/Swiss Impact.
And next week, I'm so looking forward to that.
So next week, we are having another amazing guest, Kasike Niborisk Kaiman. Mm-hmm. He has many roles, but among that, he's a member of You Speak Spanish. Maybe you can speak in Meta.
Consejo de Medicina Ancestral Indígena Originaria del Abya Yala. Council of Ancestral Indigenous Medicine of the Americas and sits on YCOIL, Yamaya Jamaica Council of Indigenous Leaders. So we are really looking forward to welcome our guest. It's a really special. Don't miss that one and subscribe on our channel. Yeah, and for those who are interested to learn about impact investing and how to make profitable business with impact, very soon we are going to publish 3 new courses on chamomile. So sign up and check it out. Anything else?
Thank you for watching us. No.
Yes, act for your future. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome to Season 3 of Swiss Impact with Banerjee's. I'm Sveta.
And I'm Ben.
The topic of Season 3 is Impact Investing, the New Normal. Do you also want to do something meaningful for our planet and people or invest with impact?
Then our amazing and powerful guests who are business owners, heads of financial institutions, thought leaders, political leaders, policymakers, investors, and experts.
Greetings, my name is Ash Pachauri and I'm the senior mentor of the POP or Protect Our Planet movement, and also a member of the board and secretary treasurer of the World Sustainable Development Forum. Our primary goal is to mobilize the 1.8 billion youth of the world to urgently address the issue of climate change and take action to protect our planet.
This will inspire you to get engaged.
And in this season, we will challenge them even more to take action towards sustainable development goals, to enable a paradigm shift in the financial sector and way of doing business.
Watch and learn how can we, as humans, transform into eco-financial system which would serve all people and the environment.
We aim for impact investment to become available to anyone, become truly mainstream.
See you every Friday at 3 p.m. Central European Time at Swiss Impact with Banerjee.
Act for your future.